Welcome back to Feminism Now, a podcast featuring leaders and activists who are on the front lines of the fight for constitutional equality, economic justice, and reproductive rights. I'm Christian F. Nunes, the national president of the National Organization for Women. Our theme this season is Women Leading Democracy, and we want to be clear. Trans women are women. NOW is committed to fighting for the rights of LGBTQIA+ people for employment, housing, healthcare, child custody, and the simple right to go to the bathroom in peace. Democracy means that all of us can live together, work together, and thrive together. Looking at the news recently, it seems like a lot of conservative politicians want to protect women and girls. Bills are being introduced across the country that seem to be about protecting women. The titles say things like protect women and girls in sports, but do they? Look a little closer. Many of these bills were actually about not who can play sports, but who can't. Often, they target trans athletes by demanding that only those assigned female at birth be able to play sports on girls' sports teams. And these bills aren't acting in isolation. Others target those, whether they're trans children and teens, should be able to receive treatment that help them to confirm their identity. And still more are often trying to ban books that cover LGBTQIA issues in schools. And they try to stop even from mentoring their own gender identities in the classroom. This isn't about protection. It is a straight out attack. And it's up to us as feminists and to be active as allies and all allies to fight with the LGBTQIA community to protect people of all identities for equal rights for all of us. I'm so honored today to speak with Charlotte Clymer. She's a trans activist, a veteran, a woman of faith, a writer, and a former press secretary of the Rapid Response arm of the Human Rights Campaign. Charlotte is just an all-around badass, and I'm so happy to be speaking with her today. So please, everybody, help me welcome Charlotte Clymer.
Christian! Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to be joining you. This is going to be amazing. You know, I'm a huge fan of you, and I'm a huge fan of NOW, and I've embarrassingly fangirled over you at the White House a couple times now, so...
I just want you to start off by like making sure you tell us a little bit about your personal story. You know, you're a writer, you're an activist, you're a veteran, you're a trans woman. Can you tell us a bit more about what led you to your current position in activism?
Oh my gosh, wow. Well, it's a circuitous path, let me tell you. I grew up in Central Texas, and I knew from an early age that something was off, and I didn't know how to explain it. I remember wanting to be a girl very, very early on, and I didn't get it. And then the older I got, the more I realized that it's not something you're supposed to say out loud at all. So it's supposed to keep it inside. And what I started doing instead was like going through, I suppose, this effort to cleanse myself of this need. So, you know, I was a pretty good kid, you know, very much a rule follower, you know, studious, wanting to really please the adults around me. And I would do or engage in these, I guess, masculine rites of passage with maybe the hope that I would stop wanting to be a girl. And it never worked. Like I played high school football. I lifted weights. I, you know, joined the military eventually. And, all these were partly because I wanted to do them, but it was also a big chunk of it because I thought maybe this will be finally the thing that removes this need. I remember praying most of my childhood, almost every day, for God to take away this need to be a girl. And it never went away. And by the time I got into my mid-20s, it was just pretty obvious that it was not going to change. Nothing I could do to remove it from myself. And then it became a process of acceptance. And then finally, I think in a very strange and unexpected way, gratitude for that kind of gender dysphoric experience growing up. I got into politics primarily after the 2016 election. So I did some political things before then, some writing, but mainly I worked odd jobs. Like I worked at the Holocaust Museum for a little while. Remember, I worked a couple minimum wage jobs along the way, did the Army, of course. After 2016, things changed very, very quickly. And my first real, like, grown-up political job was at the Human Rights Campaign. I was hired as the press secretary for Rapid Response. And my goodness, for 2.5 years, 3 years, it was like we would wake up every day with Trump saying something about LGBTQ people like at 3 a.m. with some kind of weird tweet, and then we'd have to write about it and educate folks and get that information out there. And I got to say, I love everyone at HRC. I love the Human Rights Campaign team. They are amazing. They are dedicated. They come to work every day wanting to do right by others and to protect the most vulnerable folks in our society, not just LGBTQ people, but everyone. So I'm proud to have worked there. And, you know, eventually it led to this way where, you know, most of my life now is doing writing a blog, writing op-eds. But I also do a lot of advocacy outside of that. So, you know, I'll raise money for organizations that need it. I might work on pro bono comm stuff for projects that, you know, need a helping hand. You know, just movement work that we all do. That's our the price of progress, right?
Well, I'm so glad that you've gotten to this work because it is needed. And I thank you for the work that you continue to do. But I think it's important too to talk about like why we as a whole have to make LGBTQIA plus issues part of all of our movements. So can you tell me a little bit about why, as we talk about the feminist movement, why we have to make this LGBTQIA rights part of the feminist movement?
Well, the biggest thing, the most pressing thing for me is bodily autonomy. The right of every person to have agency over their own bodies, regardless of who they are, regardless of their background. Obviously, I think the biggest pressing issue right now is the right to abortion care. Safe, affordable abortion care. With Dobbs overturning the Roe, I mean, it's been such an existentially stretching time for so many folks, but especially women and sexual minorities in states where abortion has been banned, and they have to either travel out of state or go through the courts to get access, and they have to have the money and the resources to be able to get abortion in states where it's affordable. You know, I feel like anyone who can recognize that we should have choices over our own bodies should be able to see that freedom in other people as well. We all have an interconnected thing. And it's not just abortion and trans issues. It's also, I would say, freedom from state violence. If it's, you know, unarmed Black people, unarmed people of color, having, you know, freedom from being unilaterally, extrajudicially shot by, you know, police. I mean, these are all things that are connected. It is an attack on personal agency to remove someone's freedom over their own body. And we should all be able to get on that side together.
Absolutely. And this is why it is the intersectional movement, right? Because it is something that we all should recognize and understand that this is what we can relate to, is that personal autonomy, that personal freedom to be protected, safe, and live in peace. Like, if we're all for this equality, we're all for this fairness, we're all to be able to live freely our lives and be safe to live our lives, then we should be able to support and be in solidarity and stand in solidarity and also stand in the struggle, right, with everyone. So I think that's such a great way you put it for people to understand, you know, and while we're talking about this, also to understand the importance of where we're going in this movement and the work that we have to do. I know also, too, like the last few years, it seems like there was a place of time where there was some rights and acceptance that was happening. But like you said, with Trump, a lot of things are rolled back, right? What do you think is happening? Why do you think we're seeing this increase as we're moving to this new election cycle? And just in general in our world, I guess even outside this election, but why do you think there's an increase happening with this?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I feel like a lot of very smart folks wonder that because they're outside of these issue areas and they're trying to figure out all the pieces. And I'm sad to say it's complicated. There are many factors going on here. Number one, it's complacency, I think. You know, it goes back to same-sex marriage being legalized by the Supreme Court, which was a momentous event, and I'm so glad it happened. But at the same time, it gave way to this feeling among a lot of Americans that that was the end of the LGBTQ rights struggle, that marriage was the whole thing. And in fact, marriage equality was just a small part of the overall pie. And when we look at LGBTQ rights across the country, it was actually pretty bad even before Trump came along. In 29 states, LGBTQ people do not have protection against discrimination in housing, credit, public accommodations, jury service, education, healthcare. Most folks who are LGBTQ do not have the resources to navigate a long and Byzantine court process in order to gain equality. So what we have right now is that most of the country, there's no protection against discrimination. The only two laws that are at the federal level that protect LGBTQ people are Obergefell, which is marriage equality, and Bostock, which protects against discrimination in employment. You can have the freedom, you can, well, And Siri, you won't be discriminated against if you want to get a job or you're in the workplace. And, you know, of course, you have marriage, but that's it. That's all. I think there are tens of millions of very well-meaning people who are wonderful, LGBTQ affirming on paper, but they don't understand that the situation has been dire for a long time. And Trump just made it a lot worse. He took advantage of this complacency and just inflicted just so much hatred and bigotry toward LGBTQ people to the point where we now are seeing a resurgence of hate crimes and discrimination against, I would say, the most privileged folks in the LGBTQ movement, white cis gay men, who are experiencing a resurgence of discrimination, which scares the hell out of me. Because if you're a white gay cis man and you're experiencing a resurgence of discrimination, what does that say for Black trans women who are living in the South or the Midwest? What does that say for a lesbian couple who needs abortion access? What does it say for, you know, a non-binary student in a school who has every right to be treated with dignity and respect in their learning environment? It's a bad situation right now.
Thank you for naming us, because I think it's so important to really name when you talk about the multiple identities and what that looks like with these laws and what that looks like with the rise of the attacks and the discrimination that's happening. And although, like you mentioned, there are some laws out there that have some protections, overall, there are so many loopholes that happen that can still allow people to discriminate. And then because of what's happened, right, a lot of people feel emboldened to act in violence, to speak out in violence, to act in violence, and feel like they have every right to do it. And so the more identities you have, the more that we're seeing, you know, rises in murders of Black trans and brown trans women, Indigenous trans women, right? We're seeing that. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I want to really bring this to attention, because when we look at violence that's happening in the trans population, I mean, it is horrific. It is horrific.
Yeah, the vast majority of crimes against trans people are experienced by Black trans non-binary people. I mean, this has been established through surveys, certainly through the anecdotal experience. I mean, if you talk to any trans person, you know, it's more likely they've heard of a Black trans non-binary person, especially Black trans woman, being assaulted or murdered than they would for any other population. And it's this thing where, as exactly as you said, there is an intersectionality of brutality that is at work here. You know, it's not just someone experiencing transphobia. It's, you know, misogynoir on top of that. It could be xenophobia if they come from a different country. It could be related to their religious status. Muslim trans folks, Jewish trans folks are certainly under more scrutiny and more vulnerable to violence and discrimination. I mean, I have experienced a certain level of discrimination as a white trans woman who's pretty, I think, safe overall. But the experience of Black and brown, trans and non-binary people is just far and away several magnitudes worse. So we need to, you know, when we're talking about this advocacy, it's really through a prism of not just transphobia, but white supremacy and xenophobia as well. I mean, these things are so interconnected.
And also, too, I think we can add in toxic masculinity on top of this as well. I mean, it really plays out in so many ways. And I think sometimes we forget to think about even, you know, I always point out and tell men that toxic masculinity harms you just as much as it harms everyone else in this world, you know, and it does white supremacy, toxic masculinity, misogynoir, you know, xenophobia. It all is interconnected, and it creates like just lack of safety and lack of ability to have peace for so many communities. And everyone deserves the right to have peace, right? Everyone deserves the right to live and have safety and to live freely in their own authenticity. But I think this is what part of the strategy, right? Because we know part of the strategy has been bringing up the issue of Title IX and then in sports and trans, you know, athletes and trans girls in sports and how it's unfair. Why do you think, and I have my own theory, but I want to hear yours, on why do you think this is where they keep using that as their reason and justification for why they have to have all these bans?
Yeah, so I put people who are opposed to trans inclusion in sports into two buckets, two primary buckets. you have about, I don't know, I'm just kind of guessing here. I would say like 30 to 40% of the public who are not necessarily anti-trans on paper, but they don't know a lot about, you know, the sports psychology or the medicine or trans healthcare, and they just want basic fairness. And they've been told that having trans inclusion will threaten the fairness and safety of cisgender girls and women in sports, right? It's coming from a good faith place. They don't know any better, but it's not like antagonistic toward trans people. It really isn't. But then you have this other bucket, which is about 15 to 20% of the voting public who are very much anti-trans, who are deeply uncomfortable with trans people, who are far and away more motivated by their opposition to the existence of trans people anywhere than they are about anything having to do with fairness and safety in women's sports. And it is so critical that we make that distinction, because there are a lot of good people who are confused on this issue and just don't know the information because no one's talked to them. Just as an aside, real quick, you know, when I look at LGBTQ rights, and this is not a novel approach, by the way, I don't want to act like I'm, you know, breaking new ground here, but there are two tracks. There is the legal track and the cultural track. Now, we've had some substantial success on the legal track. And for a while there, we were really going gangbusters on the cultural track. There were a lot of trans celebrities coming out, being very much welcomed into big mainstream public spaces, which is great. But there's also been a cultural backlash, especially over the past 3 or 4 years. And the reason that's happening is because there's a vacuum of information that the GOP and the social conservative movement is all too happy to fill. Meanwhile, you have very few Democrats and folks in the progressive movement who are standing strong and outspoken on this. President Biden has done a great job. This last State of the Union was the third address to Congress in which he had mentioned trans rights consecutively, which is wonderful. You have organizations like NOW, which is doing great and very pro-trans, Feminist Majority Foundation, NARAL, which is now Reproductive Freedom for All. You know, as you say, have all these women's rights organizations, the Women's Sports Foundation, for example. You know, you have a lot of organizational support for trans issues. You don't see a lot of congressional Democrats speaking up. And I think it's because of two things. I think it's because they are insecure in their own knowledge base on trans issues. They don't want to say the wrong thing. Either they're offensively or from a lack of information, right? So ignorance or offense. But the other thing is that they're worried that this won't play well in elections. They think that talking about trans issues will be a drag on them. I'm not going to name any names, but let me tell you, I've had some conversations that astonished me with some folks on the Hill to the effect that it was so clear they did not have even close to the amount of credible, accurate information that they required to make informed decisions. The way we fight this is having conversations like this and reducing shame over this topic. I am not going to shame someone because they didn't know everything there is to know about trans issues. Why would I do that? I am a trans person, so I experience transphobia and some sexism and some homophobia, but I'm also white. I'm also able-bodied. I'm not a religious minority. I'm financially okay. There are a lot of privileges that I hold and a lot of experiences that I don't have a lot of knowledge of that I need to approach with humility.
Say that again for the listeners, Charlotte.
We gotta approach experiences we don't have with humility. And believe me, we've all been through those moments where we put our foot in our mouths and it happens. But you know what? We look at what we did wrong. We try to correct it. And then we try to be a better person. How would I feel if I made a mistake in good faith and someone shouted me down and called me an evil, ugly person for it? I felt terrible. I'm not going to shove my foot down someone's throat because they accidentally misgender me or because they don't know a lot about trans inclusion in sports. I'm going to take them, get a cup of coffee, let's talk about it. Let's figure out how to fill this vacuum of information so that you're not struggling. We should be helping each other, not tearing each other down over these issues. That it's very understandable why you wouldn't know something about them in the first place, right?
This is so important you said that, because I think sometimes we forget the advantage some people have over other people and how we have to have humility sometimes, and we have to figure out ways to bring people in to be able to communicate and understand. We all have different ways we can communicate information that will be received. And that was so important that you said that. It's time for Action Now, our podcast segment where I get to tell you about some of the important issues impacting women today. We're excited to let you know about our upcoming national conference, which will be held virtually from July 19th to July 21st. It's such a wonderful opportunity for all of us to get excited about now and find community with each other. This year's topic is Women Will Save Democracy, No Democracy Without Intersectionality. And we're thrilled to present speakers in the action-oriented workshops, and it's your chance to get involved. Oh yeah, and it's election year for the National Now Board. Go to nlw.org to register for the conference, and we hope to see you there. Join us at our meeting and help us take action now. And now, back to our interview. Now that we've talked about all that, we know that an upcoming 2024 election is right around the corner. And oh my goodness, I don't know how you feel about this election, but I know it makes me think at night.
I think I feel the same way. It keeps me up at night too. It does.
And it's a critical election for many communities, and especially the rights of LGBTQIA plus community. Their lives are on the line, wouldn't you say?
Oh, that's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, I don't want to come across that way, but very measured person, I promise, to anyone listening. But I will say this, there really is no coming back from this election. This is not 2004, 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020, even as bad as 2020 was. This is not 2020. We don't come back from this. We have to beat Trump. There's no other, it's not this thing where we regroup and we come back storming in 2028 and, you know, we get a more progressive candidate that we love. And, you know, that's a fantasy. I'm sorry, it's a fantasy. We have one candidate. His name is Joseph Biden. Regardless of what you might think of him, and I think he's great, but regardless of what you might think of him, he is going to be the Democratic nominee for president. Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee for president. Trump is not even trying to hide what he wants to do now. He's being pretty explicit about what he wants to do across the board. So we have two choices. We can either save democracy or let it fall forever. And those are the two choices.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's important that, and also understanding that you may not agree with the choice you have, but you have to think about what have they done and who's more willing to do things that are not going to align with protecting your life and your rights with the other person.
That's right. I mean, look, you're just trying to get somewhere and get in a vehicle to go to that place. That's all you're doing. You're not trying to marry this person. You're not trying to say you love them. If you hate Joe Biden, say you hate Joe Biden. That's fine. That is your First Amendment right. You have every right to protest the president. As long as you're in that voting booth making the rational decision of understanding that Trump is magnitudes worse than Joe Biden will ever be, and you pull that lever for Joe Biden to reelect him and save democracy, that's all I care about. That's all I care about.
So as we talk about this, I know that there's so much that has us kind of feeling like, ooh, there's so much for us to do. But there also are some things that we could have hope for. So tell me, what gives you hope, not only in politics, but in the lives of trans joy, so we call it?
I love when I get an email or a message from the parent or older relative of a trans kid. They're so excited because they feel they have no one else to tell in their lives. They feel like they can't tell, you know, maybe their coworkers, their colleagues, their friends or whomever. So they email me and they want to tell me like, okay, so, you know, my nephew or my son or whomever came out and this is what we're doing. And I just, you know, want to talk to you about it and get some advice. And I get those messages constantly. When I'm at a conference, sometimes someone will come over and want to tell me their story. And my favorite stories are the ones that start out with, I didn't know anything about trans people. I was very skeptical. I would say that maybe I was something of a bigot against trans people. And then my kid came out and suddenly everything changed. And I realized this is not something you choose. This is not something that you can hide away or just hope it goes away. It's just how it is. And then all their focus went into getting the care and help that their kid needed. Those are my favorite stories because that is a wake-up call, and that's a wake-up call for the communities in which they reside. Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union with their trans daughter. I mean, my goodness, what a journey. And now they're two of the biggest celebrity advocates for trans rights in the mainstream.
Even relocated. They even relocated to make sure they're protecting their child. And that is unconditional love, right? You're saying, I'm not even going to live in a state that I have to even worry about the health, safety, or well-being of my child. That's unconditional. And that's important.
Sure is. And, you know, the sad thing is that the vast majority of parents of trans kids can't move. You know, I'm from Texas. And
I'm Texas. I'm H-Town.
Oh, hey, Austin. So, I mean, you know, Beyonce's from Houston. So, you know, I'll let you have that one. But, you know, it's interesting, though, because I see well-meaning folks who grew up either on the East Coast or the West Coast, and they'd be like, well, why don't you just move? Like, just move out of the state. And I like to say to them, with what money? Who's paying for that? Who's paying for that move? Who's paying for the new housing when you get to wherever you're trying to go? Who's getting you a job? Who's building a community around you? There is such an extraordinary privilege in asking, why don't they just move? Most people can't just move. They are where they are, and they're going to be there probably forever.
And I also have a problem with this, too, because I feel this way when people, and this is kind of the reason I'm also against these bans, like, don't go here, no support, because a lot of people in the communities, they're stuck because of economic inequality. And our job is to disrupt and dismantle the inequalities, systematic inequalities, not to assume that everyone has the privilege and the finances to get up and leave. Our job is to disrupt that systems. So if we are disrupting systems, we're going to change the systems in the states that are creating the inequalities, not to expect people to have the advantage and the luxury to get up and go.
There it is. You said it perfectly. That was perfect. I mean, if you have those resources, use them, certainly. But just know that the vast majority of folks, and not just LGBTQ people, but across the board, white supremacy in states, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, abortion, you know, one of the biggest ones right now, people can't just move. So you said it perfectly. We got to directly dismantle. Should we talk about the trans sports issue real quick, though?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, I really want to talk about this because I feel like there's so much disinformation. First of all, let me start here. And I'm going to be very clear about this. I do not believe that if you are a 16-year-old trans girl, that you should be able to come out on Sunday and start playing any sport you want on Monday. That's not the way it works. There has to be a reasonable process for ensuring safety and fairness for everybody involved. By the time you're 16, 17, whatever, you've gone through several years of puberty, muscular development, you have unfair advantages. That is absolutely true. But here's the flip side, which rarely gets talked about in popular media, and it drives me nuts. Here's the flip side. If you do go through hormone therapy, which is what trans teenagers encounter, they don't get surgeries. You don't get surgeries until much later when you're not a minor. But you can go through hormone replacement therapy, which does reduce and basically eliminate those unfair advantages that you have. Which is why, by the way, it's so rare for a trans girl to win a high-level competition at the high school level. In fact, it's only happened a couple times, and they were both in track and field. And the young trans women who won those state finals would also lose other state finals, sometimes not even place. Here's the thing. When a young trans girl or young woman loses a competition, no one cares. No one cares. Like, everyone just tunes out. It's when a trans girl wins a competition that it suddenly becomes an issue. That's what bothers me about it. Now, here's another thing, too, that bothers me. There's this talk of scholarships. If you had to guess, how many scholarships do you think young trans women have won at the collegiate level? If you had to guess, like, throw a number out there.
None.
You are absolutely right, my friend. There has never been a college athletic scholarship awarded to a young trans woman in the United States. It's never happened. In fact, this past year, there was a young trans woman who was awarded a college athletic scholarship as part of a volleyball program. She did not have any unfair advantages. She just worked her ass off and played well. And she was outed by other parents. And then there was backlash against the university who had offered her a scholarship, and it got rescinded because of the controversy and backlash. Not because of fairness, not because she didn't follow the rules, but because of what conservatives would glibly refer to as cancel culture. It's just a very unfair situation. And I wish people would take a breath, realize that girls and women's sports are not under any threat, according to Billie Jean King, according to Megan Rapinoe, according to the great folks at NOW and the Women's Sports Foundation. You know, there has been such a bedrock unity in the feminist movement on this issue. And the people who are trying to ban all trans kids in sports are usually coming from a place of deep ignorance and discomfort with trans people generally.
Absolutely. And their ignorance crosses over.
That's right. Into other areas as well.
But I really appreciate you pointing that out. So thank you for doing that, because I think it was really important for our listeners to really know the truth of what's happening in the sports, you know, because I think that's the biggest part, how we challenge this is giving them correct information so they're educated. And then we know if they're choosing to continue on or if they're choosing to change, you know.
Yeah, that's the other thing. Like, you know, your kid wants to wear different clothing than what's typically with their assigned gender. It doesn't mean they're trans or non-binary. Maybe they just want to experiment. Maybe your daughter just, you know, wants to wear a jeans and a polo shirt around for a while. Maybe your young son wants to wear a dress. That doesn't make them trans. That's an entirely different issue. Don't go to the worst case scenario in your brain. Ask your kid how they're feeling. Ask them what they're going through. If it gets to the point where they say, you know, mom, dad, I'm not part of, you know, this assigned group I've been made a part of, then maybe take them to a professional. Go through the appropriate pathway for getting gender dysphoria aside. It's a long process. It's a very long process. It's not this thing where you just get it overnight. You know, trust the process, trust the science, trust the medical experts.
But do not go to hate, because that's not where we know. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate this. And I really hope that it helped educate some listeners and maybe shift some minds of some listeners who maybe closed their minds to fear and lack of information. It's just so important, everyone, that we take the time to get educated and aware, because lack of knowledge is ignorance. Lack of knowledge causes harm. Let me say this again, lack of knowledge causes harm. So we want to thank you so much, Charlotte, for coming with and joining us today. We're happy you were able to speak with us. You know, I appreciate you so much and all the work you're doing. And we want to figure out one last thing you can tell our listeners and how they can too stand as authentic allies with the LGBTQIA plus folks in the community to make sure we are helping in this fight for equality.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, the National Organization for Women has been out front on these issues and been fighting for LGBT equality for so long. And Christian, you've been out front with us, doing it on the front lines. You know, donate to NOW, go to rallies, support this organization, but also just make sure that you're vulnerable enough and have the kind of righteous and healthy humility to educate yourself. You know, if you don't know something, you know, try to look it up, see what you can find. If you've done all the research and you're like, I'm so confused, then be like, yeah, let's go talk to someone who may know a little more. It can be a very fun journey to go learn things by yourself and to try to put the pieces. It's like a puzzle that you're putting together. It can be really fun to build that together and like really get yourself to a higher level of thinking.
Yes. Charlotte, thank you so much for joining us. We're so happy to be able to speak with strong women like you who are leading with thoughtfulness and grace. Thank you, listeners, for being with us as we use season 2 of our podcast to showcase people making a real difference to women and our allies in our democracy.